Okay, I will call this property tax division report March 27th to order. We do have quorum and can conduct lawful business. First on the agenda is to approve the previous minutes. Vice Chair Lee, have you had a chance to review?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I move to approve the minutes from March 20th.
Okay, it's been moved. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Minutes are adopted. All right, first on the agenda today is House File 5062. Welcome, Representative Cincimura, on your bill. Chair moves that House File 5062 be laid over for possible inclusion into the Tax Division report. To your bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lissagard and committee members. My bill, HF 5062, seeks to establish a property tax exemption that would apply to the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe's Twin Cities office, which is located in the Seward neighborhood in my district in Minneapolis. This Twin Cities office is a key location to serve the approximately 1,600 Leech Lake Band citizens who reside in the greater metro area, as well as the larger Twin Cities Native community. This property is owned and staffed by the Leech Lake Band and offers a physical location that is much closer than the 200-plus mile drive to the Leech Lake government offices in Cass Lake. Indeed, while many of those served at the Twin Cities office are my constituents, many also come to the greater metro area to access services ranging from elder programming, vaccination clinics, child welfare assistance, and a place to host community gatherings and celebrations. I have some testifiers who are remote today because of the weather and the long drive down, who can share more all about the community services that occur at the Leech Lake Twin Cities office and can share more details about the history of this parcel and answer any questions from the committee regarding the proposed property tax exemption.
Okay, well, thank you. And first up, we have the Secretary Treasurer of Leech Lake, Fine Day.
Yes.
Okay, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Leonard Finday, and I serve as Secretary Treasurer for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. And I would like to thank Chair Liz Lagarde and committee members for the opportunity to testify and support a House File 5062 today. I also appreciate the ability to offer this testimony virtually and thank the committee and staff for making this accommodation. I also would like to thank Representative Censor Murra for introducing this important legislation on our behalf. House File 5062 would authorize a property tax exemption for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe Twin Cities office building located at 2438 27th Avenue South in the Seward neighborhood of Minneapolis. The building is operated by the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe government and provides programs and services offered by the tribal government to Leech Lake citizens living in the Twin Cities metro area. The tribal government programs provided at the Leech Lake Twin Cities office include permanent space for our child welfare program, legal department, tribal assistance, and elder advocates. The Twin Cities office also offers community members access to faxing, copying, phones, computers, notary public services, and access to our monthly tribal newspaper, the Debajimon. Administrative staff are on site to update personal contact information as well for individual band members to maintain ongoing contact with the tribal government. In addition to these programs and services that are available on a daily basis, the Leech Lake Twin Cities office also hosts many community events and provides a location for on-reservation programs to provide services as needed. The Twin Cities office hosts community gatherings, vaccination clinics, expungement clinics, tribal council quarterly meetings, Toys for Tots drives, and many other activities. Leech Lake acquired this property in 2019, and there was a commercial tenant that was pre-existing in the building that Leech Lake took on when we acquired the building. This lease recently expired, and that commercial tenant is moving out. We have a need to utilize the entire parcel of property for our services that we offer at the building. And so as we explored options for the space being vacated by the tenant, we discovered that the property tax assessments would be a substantial burden for occupying the entire building solely with our government programs. Without a tenant to offset a portion of the tax obligation, the cost to Leech Lake to operate the building exclusively for government purposes would increase substantially. Currently, the property taxes represent two-thirds of the anticipated building operating costs for the current year. The result is increased costs in delivering critical important services for our urban citizens that is around triple what it would be without the property taxes. The services offered by the Leech Lake Twin Cities office are the same as those offered by other governments that benefit from exempt property tax status. As the members of this committee know, one of the unavoidable costs of conducting government business is office space and the property needed for that office space. Tripling the cost for office space reduces the quality and quantity of services that governments are able to provide. In order to expand the government services available to Leech Lake citizens through our Twin Cities office, it is necessary to limit the cost as much as possible. The Leech Lake Band is dedicated to maintaining existing programs and services available to urban band citizens, and we intend to increase and improve those services. Gaining the ability to qualify for a tax exemption based on the operation of these programs and services at our Twin Cities office would enhance the ability to pursue this intent. On behalf of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, I want to thank the committee members for their time and consideration of this important legislation and for the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to answer any questions. We also have our general counsel and legal director, Christopher Murray, who is available as well to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I do have on the list Christopher Murray. Do they want to testify or just here for questions? It's totally up to you.
I'm just here to respond to any questions as necessary. The testimony that we intended to provide was provided by Secretary Treasurer Findlay.
Okay, thank you so much. Anyone else in the audience want to testify for or against? Seeing none, member discussion. Seeing none, closing comments.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lissagard. Thank you, committee members. I'm really proud to have this facility in my district, and I hope that you consider them for this property tax exemption. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So with that, Chair renews his motion that House File 5062 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. The bill is laid over. All right. I will shift over because I'm next.
Okay. Chair Lissagard moves that House File 3992, the first engrossment, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. Okay. Correction. all right. Hang on one sec, folks. Thank you for your indulgence. Okay, so, Mr. Chair, is it your motion to move House File 3992, the first engrossment, to be re-referred to the Taxes Committee?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Chair Lissagard. To your bill.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. House File 3992 is a critical first step of several designed to help our rural ambulance service operating. I know this is an important issue to the committee and also the health committee, who has done considerable work in this area. Thankfully, I've had an opportunity to travel across the state of Minnesota with Representative Hewitt, who chairs the EMS task force. And what we have seen, we've seen that there's a crisis before us, and ambulance services that provide a critical need to all of people in the state of Minnesota is failing, and it's falling to a point where it could collapse. And the bill before you is for $122 million, and that only is a Band-Aid to stop the bleeding to be able to provide this service. And so I'm going to continue to push for this. I believe that it needs to be the full amount. And I do know and understand that there are different budget targets and stuff like that, but I'm committed to furthering this conversation as it goes through the process. So before I turn it over to the testifier, I know that guardrails in reporting is extremely important to the Chair Gomez, who is you know, frankly right in being adamant about having these in place. So if I could I have Jared walk through the reporting requirements in this bill?
Sure. Mr. Swanson.
Chair Lee and members, the reporting requirements in the bill are found in Subdivision 7, which is on page 3 of the bill text. And this subdivision would require that any recipient of the aid by the end of calendar year 2025 submit a report to the Commissioner of Revenue and to the legislature on how the aid was used. So the report would need to include the amount of aid that each provider received, the amount of aid that that provider spent on operational expenses, and the amount of aid that was spent on capital expenses. The providers would also need to include documentation sufficient to establish that the aid was spent on eligible uses, and the Commissioner of Revenue under this subdivision is allowed to request financial statements or any other information that's necessary to verify that the aid was spent on eligible uses.
Thank you, Mr. Solange. Is that sufficient?
Yep.
Okay, so next we'll move on to testifiers. First on our list is Eric Simonson. Please state your name and your affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eric Simonson. I am representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities today. The coalition is a representative of approximately 110 cities in the 80 counties outside the 7-county metro area. Generally, we advocate on issues like local government aid, property tax relief, transportation, economic development. This is kind of our first venture into the public safety space, but it is because our members have made it a high legislative priority this year. You might ask, why does the CGMC care about this bill? It is because more than half of the licenses are owned by some unit of local government across Minnesota, and many of our members participate in that. We want to focus in on the issues that are, I think, are important to the property tax division, and that is to put yourselves in the space of a local city councilor or a local mayor that happens to operate an ambulance service. Historically, revenues have come in at levels that were enough to at least break even, but for the past several years, as has been pointed out several times at several committee stops, the fee-for-service model is broken, the reimbursement model is broken, and these operations are being asked to subsidize the local ambulance operation to the tune, in some cases, of $1 million or more. It depends on the size of the service. But in the eyes of the local council, oftentimes the primary service area that the ambulance is covering goes far outside the boundaries of their city. If you as a local city councilor is being asked to support a tax levy increase for your local taxpayers to provide a service outside of that space, outside of that boundary, that is a very difficult decision to make. And that is what our members are worried about. This bill came from local government because we care about trying to find a solution. As Representative Liz Lagarde said, and we thank him for his efforts behind this, this is a make or break for us. We have literally cities that are facing decisions that they don't want to face, and that is a matter of, do we continue or do we give up this license? I don't want to get into all the components of the bill because we'd be here for an hour, but I want to just impress upon you how important this is from the property tax scope, if you will, how we need to do this. And I'll just leave you with one example quick. City of Nashwauk, which is on the west end of the range, owns and operates a local ambulance service, providing a service for several hundred square miles outside their little city of 900 people. They are facing repeated losses year after year after year and have got to the position where we cannot do this any longer. They tried to put their PSA license up for bid, try to get put out an RFP, see if anybody would provide that service for them. No one bid on it. No one. That is telling, because this is no longer a lucrative business because of the problems with the reimbursement model. So this is critically important to local units of government. We're glad that it's being heard in this committee. We're thankful for Representative Liz Lagarde and his support. And with that, Madam Chair, I would wrap up my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Simonson. Next, I have CAP. Welcome to the committee. I think this is your first time here, maybe, this year.
This year for sure.
All right, please state your name and your affiliation for the record.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Cap O'Rourke. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. We advocate on behalf of the over 700 cities with populations under 5,000. Over 90 such cities currently operate a PSA. And as Mr. Simonson noted, this has been a problem, but it has really reached a critical point. We have small communities like Nashwauk and others scattered throughout the state that are operating in EMS services that the finances coming from the insurance are not meeting their needs, and they're in the red. And some of these cities have been in the red for the last 5 to 8 years, and frankly, it's been a piece where they've been okay with it. They understand that this is a critical service and they've been able to survive. But coupled with the lack of reimbursement and the volunteer services that they've been relying on, which are becoming harder and harder to find, providing these services not only to their communities, but to the surrounding cities at all, is just becoming untenable. This $120 million across the state is needed for our small cities. The vast majority of this money, as written in this, would likely go to small communities. I've been asked this question about what is the breakdown from this bill, how it would be dispersed and go to small cities and large cities and who the operators are. The problem with that is we're not sure. We can only look at this anecdotally because a lot of this is private data, but we know based on the volunteer hours for small cities, a significant portion of this is going to go to the public programs and, more importantly, to the small cities that are struggling and having to make the decision of putting their PSA up and potentially having the situation where there is no service in that area.
Great. Thank you. Are there members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Nope. Okay. Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. I have first on my list Representative Hewitt.
I was hoping let Representative Clown go first. I can go last.
Okay.
Oh, no, sir. All right.
Sorry.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Lizegard, for bringing this forward. I am a sponsor on the bill. And it brings up a lot of questions that we heard on the task force over this was by far the largest area that the stakeholders came back to us with is revenue. They are so... under right now, and the question that we keep coming back on a lot of this is, number one, how did this happen? Doing some root cause analysis, number one, the aging population in rural Minnesota is happening, and plus the people younger are moving out of it. And so the aging population is pretty much a Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement pool. And so that gets reimbursed in Medicaid dollars for ambulance services, usually 20 to 23 cents on the dollar. And in Medicare, it's usually about 30 cents on the dollar. So when you're operating an ambulance service in rural Minnesota, you have to also have that obstacle. There's a lot of questions here. How does a volunteer service end up, like, losing all this money and things like that? And I think those are still yet to be answered. But it doesn't negate the fact that cities still have to pay the insurance on these ambulance services and pay for the ambulance, keep the updates, keep the regulatory body intact. And on top of that, they also have ongoing costs that they're absorbing, because really a lot of these places are not volunteer. They're paid on call. Even like we did a study on Representative Backer's area, and if we had to pay for full-time EMTs in his area, which we are probably looking at in the future, because we just don't have the volunteer base anymore, we would have to, and his run volume for his area was, okay, you'd have to bill out $9,800 per run in that area. And that's the average run in the Twin Cities, I think, right now is $2,500 a run. And if you don't have volume, there's no way to pay for this. So this is a serious question, and I don't know if this amount is even right, the $122 million. This could be, you know, this is a level of public safety that we have to look at, and I think it's in our value statement. And there's a lot of things this group came back with. that we're going to try to support this year. Number one was, yes, a lot of change to the regulatory arm of this. That had to be. I really feel firmly that that has to be done. The second part was looking at different ways of doing EMS is really important. We're looking at some models that we want to get out there, and we'll hear more about those bills later on. This one here, though, is we keep coming back to the question, we're going to fund it, but where are those funds going to go? And what are they going to be used for? Because I want to hear that the funds are going to make that EMT leave the garage and get on the scene. And we're funding past debt here is what we're doing, which is okay because we need to keep these ambulances out there. But that's the only call I have with this is that, you know, how do we – tell me Representative Lizegard, I'm not going to pick on you for this because you heard the same story as I did, but how do we – where's the money? Yeah, actually, your testifier, good. Madam Chair, I'd like the testifier, actually, to tell us how are the funds going to be used to keep an ambulance on the road?
Mr. Simonson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric Simonson with the CGMC again. Representative Hewitt, you, of course, raise a very excellent question. And we, of course, as the CGMC, also want that accountability and transparency, and we tried to make sure that this bill reflects that. If you look at the bill, which would be subdivision 5, eligible uses, we tried to narrowly focus this to give flexibility to the PSA holder, but at the same time put parameters around how they could spend the money. And it has to be spent on the operation within their primary service area that is located in Minnesota. So we tried to address those border communities where maybe, you know, a service in Wisconsin has part of a PSA in Minnesota. Those dollars, if they were eligible, we don't know that they are, but if they were eligible, they would have to be spent on operations within the PSA within those borders. Beyond that, I think there's some level of understanding and hopefully trust with our local units of government and other license holders that those monies would be spent to keep those operations going.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Simon, who do you see, I looked at the bill, who do you see dispersing these funds? Is it the regulatory arm or is it, who is it?
Mr. Simonson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt. Also a good question. The way the bill is written, the monies would be distributed by the Department of Revenue. And they would go out with the second half of the year local aid payments on December 26th. So no dollars would run through the EMSRB, but the EMSRB would obviously play a role in this process, but no dollars would run through the EMSRB.
Representative Hewitt?
I'm done for now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think I had next Lead Quam, but I think Representative Hollins also wanted to make a comment. So Lead Quam, would you like to wait for... Okay. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lizegard, for bringing this bill. You know, I guess I'm not going to get into the – I'm not going to grill you like this one over here
thank
does.
You, thank you.
But I am – I mean, so I'm thinking about this, and I represent and live in the city of St. Paul, which doesn't have the same issues, right? But my family and my parents live in a rural community. And so this is actually really near and dear to my heart. And we're currently looking at trying to help them relocate into a city specifically because of this. Because when my mom was having an allergic reaction, she drove herself to the ER, and we were like, that's a terrible idea, right? Like, you could have veered off the road, your throat was swelling up, et cetera. Like, it's just a really horrible system. And I guess when I'm hearing folks say that, you know, having these ambulances is no longer a lucrative business, it makes me think that this is not something that should be a business to begin with. Like, this is an essential service that we are providing to the people of Minnesota to keep them safe, to keep them healthy. And I think maybe we need to take a sort of 10,000-foot level look at this and say, what is the system that we want to live in? Is it a system where only things that are generating a profit are things that are we're going to pursue? Or are we going to look at this as actually the services that we need to provide to our people especially our elderly community members in Greater Minnesota, to make sure that they have access to this and make sure that they're healthy and taken care of. And to my mind, that's a really important consideration. And it's something that I think we really need to reevaluate just in general, the system that we're having, because even when something's not financially lucrative, it can still be important. And we still need to value that. And really, when we talk about taxes, that is what we're doing. We're taking our money and putting it where our mouth is. We can say we love seniors. We can say that we want to support Greater Minnesota. That's what these tax dollars are doing. When we tax the people, we use that money to provide those services to those communities. And for that reason, I don't think we need to look... We need to reevaluate how we're thinking about taxation, because the people who are benefiting from it are the people that we claim to care about. And so when we're professing our care for the aging population, for children, for folks who, you know, whatever, have disabilities and live in communities where they don't have those services available, these taxes are helping to make sure that they are able to live their fullest, best lives. And so thank you for bringing this forward. I think I really think that we need to reevaluate how we're thinking about all of these services. I appreciate you.
Chair Lascar, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, you brought, thank you, Madam Chair. And you brought up a lot of good points. Everybody knows me. And where I'm from and why I continue to fight and who I'm fighting for. And in Greater Minnesota, we don't have the tax wealth that a lot of the communities down here have. We have a lot of issues that that people take for granted that are just, they're really coming up. This is a broken system. This system was designed, I don't know, in the early 80s when there was more people, younger, big vigor and vitality. People had more civic engagement, more volunteerism, not so many mandates, right? And when you start to add all this up, aging population, have to go farther away, Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement rates at the federal level that we can't control are not helping, and we don't have the volume that Representative Hewitt just said. Right, at 9,800 in backers to do an ambulance run versus 2,500 there. I mean, we don't have it, and then we don't have the wealth, the tax. I wish I had all the businesses up north where we could just raise the levy just a little bit. That's why for the schools, we can't get pass a operating referendum because we don't have no tax wealth. Right? If you don't have tax wealth, then it goes on to the homeowners. Well, we're aging people. We're on fixed incomes. There's nothing to get. Yeah. And that's why I'm here fighting for it. This $122.5 million just stops the bleeding. It stops the bleeding. Why did I go after Big Pharma? Because Big Pharma is making billions of dollars in our rural hospitals. The system as a whole is starting to collapse. Where are they going to cut? They're gonna consolidate, and they're gonna cut in Greater Minnesota. They're gonna cut where the poorer people are, and that's the people that I represent. This $122.5 million is extremely important to more important to Greater Minnesota than the 7-County Metro. I love the 7-County Metro because you guys contribute so much of the wealth that you do help us. But this system is broken. It needs to be fixed. I appreciate Representative Hewitt's determination. I'm not for giving $122.5 million, and the next thing you know, they come back next year and say, hey, can we have some more money? No. The system is broken. We got to figure it out. We got to stop the bleeding so they don't file bankruptcy and take care of it. They came to us about this, and it's our job to try to manage through it and to come out on the other end to provide the services that everyone deserves in the state of Minnesota.
That was a amazing closing, if I ever heard one. But we do have a couple more folks on the list. Thank you, Chair Lissigard. I have next Rep. Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Lissigard, for bringing this forward. I will say, I mean, it's obviously not as acute a crisis in the metro area, but I have heard from my community about this crisis as well. And it is something we absolutely need to fix. It's something we need to take action on, absolutely. Really, my question is just more around clarity. I'm seeing in subdivision 5, and this I think this may be what you were referring to with the guardrails and in terms of Chair Gomez, but I just want to make sure I understand this. So in subdivision 5, eligible uses, the only eligible use defined is that it must be, the aid must be spent in the primary service area located in Minnesota. And then there are the reporting requirements on the uses and so on. So I think just to make sure I'm understanding this, the reporting requirements are around capital expenses and operational expenses and so on. But those are not limits on how that aid would be spent. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Coulter, I think I'm going to, or Representative Coulter, pardon. I'm going to probably direct your question to Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and Representative Coulter, that's correct. So Subdivision 5 outlines the eligible uses, and it simply says that the aid must be spent within the provider's primary service area within the state of Minnesota. And then those the reporting requirements require, when submitting the report in 2025, it requires the providers to say how much of that aid was spent on each of those uses listed in Subdivision 7, but those are not included in Subdivision 5.
Thank you. Representative Coulter.
Thank you. That's helpful. And I think, I think more so just for a point of information, I think it might be helpful to have sort of greater clarity on beyond those sort of other expenses what this aid might be spent on, because I think we obviously want to make sure that it's going to the places it's supposed to go and that we know what where this aid is going. So thank you. That was helpful. Thank you.
Great. And Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple of questions, and again, thanks for the bill. Support it. This is badly needed. Just a couple of clarifications, and maybe Mr. Simonson can talk about this. Again, I'm talking about Subdivision 5 as well, eligible expenses in the primary service area. Well, back home where I am, Glenwood, DeMoris, or Benson, for example, they may make an emergency run up to St. Cloud or Fargo. Would that be out of their territory and not be eligible for this reimbursement?
Mr. Simonson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. That's a very good question. There are times when licensed ambulance services will make trips outside their primary service area, for example, on a transfer or to some one-off situation where they have to make a run outside of their district. That is not meant to be restrictive in terms of them receiving aid. The point of Subdivision 5 was that we want to ensure that any aid received by that licensed ambulance service spends that money on services they're providing within their PSA. So in the example that you brought up, I would say that 99.89% of the time they're going to be operating within their primary service area. And it's really meant to capture daily operational expenses, staffing, personnel, benefits. Perhaps it's capital expenses, they're paying bonds on an ambulance or whatever the case may be. But that would not restrict them from applying for aid or receiving aid. But we want to make sure that they're spending money on services provided within their PSA. That was the intent.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. Yep. Well, again, we realize that this is needed, $120 million, and I, some have characterized this as a Band-Aid, and it's a short-term fix. And if, in fact, we aren't going to get this aid without some kind of reform yet this session, the clock is ticking. And well over half done with the session, and just concerned that if this isn't done quickly and get that aid out there to those that need it, and then again come back possibly next session or in the interim and do some of this badly needed reform on reimbursement rates, I'm just concerned that it may get bogged down and not done this year. But again, it's badly needed. Thanks for the initiative, and let's move this forward.
Thank you. And last but not least, Lead Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was a little bit surprised that the phrase lucrative was used, because when I was on the EMSRB a long time ago, I had some exposure to multiple different areas. I've got family members that have served on as volunteers in these services, and I've never seen you know, that anything that would have that reference to it. The first testifier, I disagree with the statement about recent, you know, shortfalls. As long as I've been aware in my area of the state, there have been historic shortage of, you know, they come short. The fees don't cover, and they've been locally subsidizing this service. There's discussion, well, what if they cover an area that's outside? I know of services that are no longer there, so the surrounding services are taking and sharing, you know, these days of this week and et cetera. So there is some coverage, but it's not directly from that area. You know, so this has been a long-standing problem. The discussion about subdivisions 5 and 7, you've got a list in subdivision 7. What about the things that, because of subdivision 5, don't fit into the categories of uses in subdivision 7? Is that just listed as other? Maybe the staff could let me know.
Yeah, I will turn the question over to Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, the items that are listed in subdivision 7 are the only things that need to be included in the report. If there were expenditures sort of outside of those categories, the provider could certainly include it in the report, and the commissioner may request sort of financial documentation of what some of those other uses were, but it's not listed as a requirement like the capital expenditures or the operating expenses.
Lead Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's what I said, other, that don't fit in those categories. So what we've hearing is there is no reporting then of the other because it's not in those categories. You know, that seems to be a bit of a weakness. The previous bill, I enjoyed that the facility that they had was inside the metro, so they have people that needed medical care, had a place to go, and it increased accessibility and provided for better or decreased disparities in health care, and I was glad to hear that bill. Disparities are present because of where you live in the state of Minnesota. Historically, funding sources from the fees have not covered the costs. You know, I came prepared so I didn't have to roll up my sleeves because this is a topic that really needs a lot of attention. And frankly, when we had tens of billions, I would have loved to have seen a bill like this before us so we can actually try to address. There, Band-Aids are great, but there are a lot of conditions that they won't really help on. And frankly, it's disappointing, especially considering that we have no idea where the extra 100 and some, you know, what is your total? 125 million. And, you know, on the supplemental budget, you know, they're 16 million. The total supplemental budget is less than 478 million. So it's a huge part of the money that we're guessing is going to be available. But the appropriate time to have done this was last year when tens of billions of dollars were available and we gave the attention, but the spotlight wasn't on it then. And I'm not sure if this bill, first of all, help of any measure is appreciated. And I know people that have gone out understaffed on a call to help, because you don't let the fact that you don't have everything keep you from doing what you can do. But the frustration and disappointment are echoes, mere shadows of what I heard after last year.
Thank you, Lead Quam. And Chair Lissigard, closing comments.
I just appreciate your support. Further conversations. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Chair renews his motion that House File 3992, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the Taxes Committee. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Hearing none, the motion is adopted and the bill is re-referred to the Taxes Committee.
Okay, welcome. Chair moves House File 4540 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. To your bill, Representative Kowalski.
Thank you very much, Chair Lissigard and members of the committee, for the opportunity to hear House File 4540, which is a result of conversations between the Cook County Board of Commissioners and the Grand Portage Reservation. Grand Portage owns 5 parcels of land that are outside of its current reservation boundaries and within Cook County and District 1. The Cook County Board has determined in working with the VAN that it does not wish to assess property taxes over these specific 5 parcels, and in cooperation with the VAN is asking the legislature to deem them to be tax exempt. I just wanted to note that the county was here. They had to leave, but wanted to make sure that you know they're very proud and worked to bring this bill forward and support it. There's a letter in your packets from the Cook County Board to this effect. And I'd also just note, Chair and members, that were this land owned by any other unit of government, be that state, local, federal, it would actually be tax exempt already. These 2B lands are all rural, vacant, and used for public use. And it's just that our statutes simply don't include tribal governments among the list of governments that enjoy that property tax exemption. And so that is the reason for this bill. Pretty straightforward. And I have also a testifier here to help fill in any gaps and answer questions. I'll turn it over to my testifier, Chair.
Please state your name for the record. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Reed LeBeau, and I represent the Grand Portage Band. We appreciate Representative Kozlowski bringing this bill, and we appreciate the partnership that we have with Cook County. They brought this idea to us, and we've tried to narrowly tailor the language so that it specifically just refers to the 5 parcels. That's similar to the bill that you heard earlier and bills that have been passed in previous tax bill iterations, where when it's property owned by a tribe, the language is specific to the particular parcel in the city. As Representative Kozlowski said, the reason that's needed is because the tax-exempt statute, it delineates all the other types of governments, federal government, state government, and municipalities, but tribes are not included in that list. And so that's why you see this bill and earlier bills. So we take it from more of a surgical approach than just a blanket exemption across the board, and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, I don't see any other testifiers. Anyone from the audience want to testify for or against? Seeing none, member discussion? Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any reason that we don't, from your perspective, just like do a general blanket exemption for these lands that are held by tribes that are outside of their the reservation boundaries? To your point about, you know, kind of governments enjoying tax exempt status, I'm just wondering if, from your perspective,
Mr. LeBeau.
Sean. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Chair Gomez. I think Monday, when this first came about roughly a decade ago, the concern was that tribes hold properties in different ways, and what has been exempted up until this point are, in this case, public use, or in the case of the earlier bill, a government building where government services are being provided. There could also be properties that are revenue-generating properties, which would then be subject to taxation if it's off the reservation and being used for business. So a blanket exemption wouldn't take into account those different uses.
Anyone else? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, has these parcels recently been purchased, or have they been generating taxes up to this point? What's kind of the back history here?
Mr. LeBeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Anderson. I can't tell you the exact amount of time that the band has held these properties. It has been some time, and they have been paying property taxes on them. And I think that's what spurred Cook County to say, you know, if it were any other type of government that held these particular parcels, we wouldn't be generating tax revenue off them, and that's what started the conversation. But I'd be happy to follow up with you with the exact timeline.
Representative Anderson? Lee Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for curiosity, you know, especially with the low population, and I assume that there's not a lot of business climbing up there, so you're doing this tax exemption, but in 5 years, 10 years, something opens up and there's a, you know, something is built on this land that is now generating income. You know, it could be any kind of business. I don't know. I'm not trying to guess. But if you switch from the current and historic, this really, you know, isn't an income type thing to where it's making a lot of money, then does it automatically go back to the tax rolls?
Mr. LeBeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Quam, from your lips to God's ears, if we're able to put something up there that's going to generate a ton of money, that would be fantastic. But if the use were to change, then the exemption would go away.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted that for, you know, the record, but also people, you know, public listens to this. And so it's key. And you might have noticed a few weeks ago that the largest helium find was up in northern Minnesota. And it's, I heard the word billions utilized. It could be a huge thing. So we don't know what might happen to present, and so now the people see that this is a reasonable thing to do now, and that if there was something changing dramatically in the future, then circumstances would change. So thank you for that, and thank you for the bill.
Okay, anyone else? Seeing none, closing comments.
All right. Well, thank you, members, for, again, hearing this bill and the great questions and discussions. I think this is a shining example of what can happen when we come forward with responsive solutions and work together across all levels of government, and ask for your support in including this in your omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you for bringing this forward. Chair renews his motion that House File 4540 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. The bill is laid over. Okay, the last bill we have up is 50 House File 5046. Chair moves that House File 5046 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. And before us, we have Representative Carly Batoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's great to be in property taxes. It's my first time. I wanted to give you all a bit of a background about House File 5046. And I have the City of Eden Prairie with me today to talk to you about the ongoing efforts in our community and to support the changing needs of communities like mine all across the suburban area. So the Southwest Metro is changing. All across Minnesota, we're changing, and we embrace that. However, our economy is also changing, and not necessarily in ways that we could have or should have predicted. The project site, which is the focus of this tax increment financing bill, is nearly 50 years old. It's our Eden Prairie Center. The Eden Prairie Center was featured in the movie Mallrats and Mallrats 2, and also Drop Dead Gorgeous. I know the chair himself has interest in the movie industry, so just wanted to share those tidbits.
Nice plug, nice plug.
But since 1976, when the Eden Prairie Center first opened, consumers have dramatically changed the way that they purchase goods. And these changes have impacted the future of the large retail facilities in Eden Prairie and across the country. So our Eden Prairie Center is beginning to experience decline and has already seen dramatic reductions in property value. These aren't positive signs for our region, and we're hoping to get in front of some of the challenges that these sites face. So my community is hoping for climate-friendly and transit-friendly redevelopments and investments that celebrate the diverse communities and leverage public investments in our region in the Southwest Light Rail project. House File 5046 can help us do this by providing the tools needed to redesign and complement current usage. So there is some precedent for this bill. We understand the same legislation was granted by tax committees previously to the City of Burnsville in 2021 to help them address similar issues related to their aging mall and the decline that was beginning there. Mr. Chair, I would now like to kick it over to my testifier, Eden Prairie's Economic Development Director, Dave Lindahl, who can certainly answer most of the committee's questions, if not all of them, and cover some additional detail about the bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Dave Lindahl, City of Eden Prairie. I'm the Economic Development Manager. A lot of people say director. Thank you for giving me a couple minutes to talk about the mall. Yeah, the Eden Prairie Mall, it's the third largest mall in the state of Minnesota. It's got 1.4 million square feet of space, five department stores, four are privately owned. All the inline retail and JCPenney's is actually owned by one owner. And that's the part of the mall that's really challenged economically right now. There's 2,400 jobs at the mall, and those people come from all over the metro area. And it attracts visitors from throughout the region. In its heyday, it attracted 12 million visitors annually. And unfortunately, since COVID, that's down to about 7 million. So the mall really is a regional attraction, and it's both a local and a regional asset. But like many malls around the country, it's struggling economically. Its value plunged 65% over the last 4 years. It was $85 million in 2019. It's down to $30 million, which is basically land value. The inline retail is at record high vacancies, and the mall ownership has actually reverted back to the lender in 2020. So it's really never recovered from COVID. And again, the department stores, most of them are doing fine, but we're talking about the inline retail. So the city's been encouraging the mall to consider redeveloping the poorly performing parts of the mall to uses that are complementary to retail. And that might help support the retail, like hotels and office and residential. And they're doing that. They're working on a plan right now for a major redevelopment. Which we very much support, and we believe the plan will help prevent further decline of the mall. We think it'll help maintain the current employment levels, and we also think it will significantly increase the value of the mall. But even though the mall is almost 50 years old, it's still physically functional, even though it's heading towards economic obsolescence. So what we're asking for is to be able to use TIF, the flexibility to use TIF, to be able to support the mall's efforts if they're needed. We don't know yet. It's a little bit early in the process, but TIF is our primary tool for helping this type of redevelopment. And if we could get some help in meeting the blight test through this bill, we'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
I do see any other testifiers. Anyone from the audience want to speak for or against? Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lind, also being familiar with the Eden Prairie area, a lot of infrastructure there. The Eden Prairie community is one of the, on a per capita basis, either adjusted net tax capacity or referendum market value, one of the most property wealthy communities in the state. Given the dynamics and the demographics of that region, do we really need an incentive or a subsidy to redevelop a property that is located so close to the interstate, located to so many people with high levels of discretionary income? Is an incentive/subsidy really necessary?
Mr. Linda.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative. It's too early in the process to know what the economic gaps in this deal will be, but what we're hearing early on is that the demolition costs are going to be significant. And so they're discussing with the city, you know, how do we close this gap to move forward? And so we're just, you know, like we've done in many other cases over the last 20 years, we're just looking at the tools that we have, like tax increment, to see if it makes sense for the city to participate.
Yep, thank you.
Yep.
Representative Garofalo?
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Lee Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as Representative Garofalo brought up, location, location, location. And with this being a huge metro area, I'm just surprised. I don't know if the management made some mistakes, because with the, you know, the infrastructure and everything else, if I was going to, open a retail or even a, you know, any kind of business that wants traffic and foot traffic and visibility, that's a prime location. So it puzzles me a little bit that it's doing so poorly. What is the impact of doing this TIF on other aspects of the community? Because you're shifting focus, resources, you know, to this one. What is going to then suffer, some sort of a lessening of emphasis? How is this, you know, what part of Eden Prairie is going to be hurt because you're diverting all the funds there?
Mr. Lindell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, first of all, I think the biggest impact on malls across the country is the increase in online shopping. I think that's hit a lot of malls and retail hard. I think the mall's been managed pretty well. They've had pretty consistent management for many years, but at the end of the day, there's just less shoppers coming into the mall. I mean, fortunately, some of the department stores like Shields are knocking it out of the park. Target's doing well, but in terms, they're not, that foot traffic isn't going from Shields into the mall, unfortunately. So that is the part of the mall that's really struggling. In terms of the impacts on a TIF deal, we don't know yet, because we haven't really, you know, we don't know what their ask would be. We haven't really analyzed it. We just want to be proactive in preventing it from any further decline. So, that's, you know, we want to be open to the idea of being able to use TIF if it's needed. And we've been very conservative with our use of TIF over the years. So we'll look at that very closely and kind of vet the need very closely with our financial advisors.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I'm getting from your testimony is that the shopping malls are a dinosaur that is moving towards extinction because of online shopping, which makes me wonder why pour resources into something that is a dying entity. Either it's not a dying entity and you've got a great location and you got to figure out what's going on to have success, or it is a dying entity, and why be throwing good money after bad? Instead maybe look at a redevelopment with TIF that would be forward-thinking and allow the community expansion and growth and vitality into the future. So I guess I'm a little bit reluctant on this because of the conflicting of reasons. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, seeing none, last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for this discussion today. I think Representative Quam, you almost took the words right out of my mouth. But, you know, we're looking at this flexibility in TIF so that we can rejuvenate and redevelop the center and the area surrounding the center. Eden Prairie doesn't have a traditional downtown space. The Eden Prairie Center is the center of Eden Prairie. And so because it is so close to a couple of the light rail stations that once the Southwest Light Rail gets up and running, hopefully before my children graduate from high school, then there'll be a lot of traffic coming in and out of that area. We know that the business community has supported that simply because of the economic impact that it will have. We've built up some additional apartment buildings and complexes, and so I think that, you know, what Mr. Lindell was talking about is the, you know, some of the department stores that just are not seeing the volume for the space that they used to in and out of the mall, because people are shifting their dollars on, to online, and whether they're buying from jcpenney.com, they're still supporting the store itself potentially, but they don't necessarily need the space that they have at Eden Prairie Center. And so what can we do to kind of redevelop and revitalize that area to enhance the future of the city? And I think one of the other concerns that I have is, you know, if not for some of the flexibility through TIF, residents would pay more through city and county taxes in order to contribute to this redevelopment. So I think just a little bit of flexibility for the region as a whole. We know that the Mall of America had difficult times during COVID. The Southdale Center has done a lot of different redevelopment, and we mentioned Burnsville earlier. So I think that, you know, we see a lot of exciting opportunity in this property, and we're just looking for a little bit of flexibility. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, and your success is our success. So thank you for bringing this forward. Chair renews his motion that House File 5046 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. The bill is laid over. All right, that concludes today. Hope everybody enjoys their break, and we'll see you on the backside. Meeting is adjourned.